Welcome back. In this lecture, I will consider a few of the major problems that were faced by the Roman and Han empires and how they responded to them. And we ended last lecture with the figure of the emperor as the person in charge who had the capacity to shape state policy. And, of course, when the emperor was a wise or a conscientious man, his sweeping powers could be an asset. But what happened if he was a weak or even, let's say, an incompetent ruler? And let's push this even a little bit further and consider a worst-case scenario. What would happen if the seemingly omnipotent ruler of one of these empires was actually insane? Well, such a situation actually occurred repeatedly in both ancient Rome and China. And oddly enough, these instances offer us an interesting test of both the extent and the limits of the emperor's power. And accounts of these rulers raise the question, how much did it really matter to the empire as a whole if its leader was crazy? To begin with, the behavior of egomaniacal or insane emperors always tended to fall into certain patterns. And one of the most common of these was the sort of murderous rampages that I've already described with Roman emperors such as Caligula or Nero. And we see very similar events in China as well. So in the same way that Nero liked to wander around Rome at night mugging random people, the Chinese emperor Wen Xuan was prone to drunken fits in which he would tear off his clothing, run around naked, and kill people. And his guards actually adopted the practice of always keeping ready at hand some condemned criminals. So whenever the emperor was struck with one of these killing urges, these could just be offered up to him. Another tendency was for these sorts of emperors to give extravagant honors to people who were their personal favorites. And in extreme cases, this would even be extended to animals or inanimate objects. So the Roman emperor, Elagabalus, made his favorite dancer the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. He put his barber in charge of the state grain supply, and he assigned a cook whom he liked to be in charge of tax collection in the empire. As we've already seen, Caligula planned to have his favorite racehorse, Speedy, appointed to the very highest political office, the consulship. Well, if we look at China, one emperor of the northern Qin dynasty gave official salaried posts to horses, chickens, and dogs. And once when a tree protected Emperor Shi Wang Di from a sudden rainstorm, in gratitude, he bestowed upon the tree the rank and the salary of an official of the fifth grade. Another recurrent theme is crazy emperors having the delusion that they were so powerful that they could even affect forces of nature. So Caligula once declared war on the ocean, and he had the Roman legions draw up on the beach and throw their spears into the sea. And then he declared that he had vanquished the god of the sea, Neptune, and he had his soldiers go around the beach and collect seashells, which he then displayed as evidence that he had triumphed over the waters. Once when Shi Wang Di became angry at a mountain, he had all the trees on it cut down as a way to punish the mountain. And these sort of actions are not unique to the absolute rulers of Rome and China, I should mention. For example, when a storm at sea destroyed the great bridge, which was built across the Hellespont by Xerxes, the Persian king of kings, he responded by ordering his soldiers to flagellate the water with whips as punishment. Lavish expenditure on palaces and banquets that exceeded even the usual ostentatious living standard of such monarchs is another hallmark of these kinds of rulers. One Chinese empress insisted that exotic fruits had to be brought to her from far in the south by a stream of couriers whose route was so arduous that many of them actually died along the way bringing her these fruits. The palace built by the Han emperors was a huge complex of multiple pavilions and halls, and all of them were furnished in the most extravagant way imaginable. But maybe the most outrageous palace of all was one built by the Emperor Nero. And this was after a fire had destroyed a lot of the city of Rome in 64 AD. And so he saw this as an opportunity. He took advantage of the space that had been cleared in the center of the city by this disaster to build for himself a giant new palace, which was known as Nero's Golden House. And it had all kinds of features. It had a triple colonnade that extended for an entire mile. It had an artificial lake. It had elaborate pavilions and gardens, which were stocked with all kinds of exotic wild animals. And it even had one complex of over 140 rooms, which was just used for hosting feasts and dinner parties. And within that complex, there was a special octagonal dining room that had a revolving roof and fountains flowing at the sides. And then out in front of the Golden House, he placed what was the crowning touch to this entire complex. Nero put a colossal, golden, 120-foot-high, naked statue of himself. And at the dedication of this extraordinary set of structures, Nero's comment was, "Well, finally, I can begin to live like a human being." By the way, today, some of those rooms of the Golden House, including that octagonal dining room, still survive, but they're buried deep beneath the Esquiline Hill. And I've been down in those kind of cave-like passages, and you can still see down there traces of the once magnificent wall paintings. Inevitably, when discussion of these sorts of emperors comes up, people always ask, why did so many emperors seem to have been insane? And certainly if we look at the Roman side, they had a terrible track record in that regard. If we consider just the first century of the empire, then at least Caligula, Nero, and Domitian, certainly by modern clinical standards, would probably have been classified as mentally unbalanced. And you'll hear a lot of popular theories regarding this. So sometimes you'll hear that this was due to incest or lead poisoning, and this is what caused all the nutty emperors. But those theories simply aren't true. One definite pattern, though, that can be detected among them is that the overwhelming majority of the most erratically behaved emperors all tended to assume the throne at a young age, often when they were just teenagers. And maybe there really is something to that old cliche that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And if one is given such total power before your adult personality has been fully formed or stabilized, then maybe it's simply too much to handle. And in China, even though the pattern isn't quite as clear as at Rome, indeed, many of the weaker or more eccentric emperors also ascended the throne in their youth. Let's return now to our initial question. How much did this sort of behavior affect the empire as a whole? And there's no doubt that for those who live directly under the emperor's gaze and within the range of his voice, it could matter a great deal. As we've seen, the victims of a mad emperor's rampages tended to be those people who were closest to him, his family, his advisors, and really anybody living in the palace of the capital city. Let's say, though, that you were a farmer living in one of the outlying provinces of either the Han or the Roman Empire. Did it really affect you in any meaningful way, whether your ruler was a person like Augustus or someone like Nero? Given those limitations on communication and the structure of the administration, a realistic answer would probably have to be no, not very much, if at all. So, well, on the one hand, the great size of these empires and the difficulties with communication are usually portrayed as weaknesses. These could, at times, also cover up or at least alleviate other defects. In this case, it could allow the bureaucratic body of the state to continue to function smoothly and at least adequately, even if the head of that bureaucratic body, the emperor, was inattentive or even crazy. Next, I want to consider two other problems that faced Rome and ancient China. And both of these have to do with outsiders. First, how do you incorporate the people that you've conquered into your empire? And how do you redirect their energies to work for the state rather than against it? And secondly, how do you deal with threats to security from outside the empire, most commonly in the form of warlike nomadic barbarians? In regard to assimilating conquered territories, the Chinese rulers had a much simpler situation. Because most of the areas that were incorporated into the Han Empire already shared the same basic culture. And so even if there are local variations, these could be relatively easily absorbed. In addition, Chinese culture really had no competition. It was universally viewed by everybody in the area as the oldest, most superior, dominant culture. So even if people might speak a regional dialect of Chinese, the standardization of the written script that had happened back under the Qin ensured that documents could be understood every place. And also, since one of the most obvious mechanisms for social and economic advancement, service in the imperial administration, depended on knowledge of Chinese classic texts in order to be successful at those examinations, this means that there's a very strong incentive for ambitious locals to assimilate even further into the mainstream culture. And really, as much as the Qin dynasty gets castigated later on, its policy of standardizing things, such as the script, weights, measures, and coinage, all of this had sunk in deeply, and all of it then helped to unify China in cultural terms. In the Roman world, it's a very different story. While Rome was successful in conquering the whole Mediterranean basin and forcing a political unity over that territory, within it, there was enormous cultural diversity. And this diversity was perfectly acceptable to the Romans. And indeed, it was one of the reasons for the success of their empire. Because in general, they did not try to enforce any sort of cultural or ethnic, linguistic or religious conformity. And so they would allow all these little local variants to thrive within the borders of the empire. While the Romans were pretty content to allow most people within their empire to retain their indigenous traditions, the one group that they did often deliberately try to co-opt or Romanize were local elites. The Romans, as a policy, tended to favor certain members of the local elite, whether you define that by social or economic status. And they would then try to use these people to control the behavior of their subordinates. For example, often the sons of local chieftains would be a little bit coercively invited to Rome, where they would be raised together with aristocratic families. And there they would be exposed to Roman culture and values, and so, having been assimilated, when they returned to their native districts as the next generation of leaders, they would now sympathize with Rome, and they would, in essence, represent Roman interests and enforce Roman policies. And those men were often given Roman citizenship. And so within a generation or two, they had even dropped their original names and taken Latin, Roman names, and they had fully adopted Roman customs. They could then even hope to become senators themselves and have careers as Roman administrators. And this whole process by which the provincials are assimilated is usually called Romanization. In an argument that would be echoed centuries later by European colonial powers, the Romans often justified the brutality of their imperialism by claiming that they were simply bringing the benefits of civilization to the people that they conquered. They would claim that incorporation into the empire gave to their subjects things like peace, law, public works, order, technology, culture, and even entertainment. And this was an argument that many of those locals, especially the elites, were perfectly happy to embrace. The Romans were very well aware of the lure that being associated with the power and success of Rome, and that the trappings of Roman civilization exerted upon those ambitious local elites. And they would cleverly exploit that desire. In his work describing the conquest of Britain, the Roman author Tacitus is very honest about the means by which Rome attempted to suborn and Romanize local leaders. Tacitus writes that the Britons were offered the temptations of arcades, baths, and sumptuous banquets, and further, that the sons of the chiefs were educated in the liberal arts, so that instead of loathing the Latin language, they became eager to speak it effectively. And our national dress came into favor, and the toga was everywhere to be seen. Tacitus also rather cynically notes that these men, the local elites, were more than willing to exchange their freedom for these sorts of amenities. And he concluded that the Britons spoke of such novelties as civilization, when in fact they were the means of their enslavement. The other great mechanism of Romanization in the provinces was the army. And we'll look at the Roman army in a future lecture in more detail. But in addition to the legions, which were made up of Roman citizens, there was another branch of the army called the auxilia. And this was made up of non-citizens. And typically, they were recruited from the most warlike or recently conquered people of the empire. And in the auxilia, these provincials would be trained in Roman fighting methods, and then they would serve a 30-year stint of service. And at the end of that time, when they were discharged, they were given Roman citizenship. And so, provincials who would enter into the auxilia with their own language, customs, and cultures would come out of it at the end of that time as Latin speakers who had fully adopted Roman ways, beliefs, and customs. And these retired auxilia would often disperse back to whatever home village they came from. And there, they would often become local officials or magistrates, and they would be representatives, almost ambassadors, of Roman authority and culture. And in this rather clever way, the energies of thousands of potential enemies of Rome were instead channeled into serving Rome. The military also acted as a means of social mobility, because advancement within its ranks was based on merit and ability. This strategy of assimilating and Romanizing provincials is really one of the great secrets to the success and the longevity of the Roman Empire. So it not only redirected the efforts of the very people who might have fought against Rome into fighting for it, but it also provided a constant source of new talent for the Romans. And scholars have done various studies of the composition of the Roman Senate, and what they found is that during the Empire, the men running Rome very quickly began to be drawn from the provinces. And the percentage of actual Italians in the Senate rapidly declines after the first century AD. And so these statistics show that Rome's success in assimilating the best and the brightest of the people that they conquered and then putting them to work for Rome. We can also see this trend reflected in where the emperors come from, their place of origin. In the first century of the empire, almost all the emperors, or all of them in fact, came from old aristocratic Italian families. But by the beginning of the second century AD, what's regarded as the high point of Rome in the time of the five good emperors, they were starting to come from provincial elites. So the model good emperor Trajan was Spanish. The emperor Septimius Severus was African. And Rome thrived at least partially because of its openness to incorporating such new talent. As already mentioned, the core geographic region that made up most of China, had cultural uniformity. But the frontiers and the fringe areas around that were much more analogous to the Roman provinces. And in those more culturally diverse regions, we find a situation very much like that in the Roman Empire, in which locals were often seduced into adopting Chinese culture. And also, the army functioned not only as a means of fighting outsiders, but as a mechanism for assimilating them. When tribes of nomadic barbarian invaders would come into contact with China, not infrequently they would end up imitating Chinese customs. And one of the more successful ways that China dealt with invaders was by simply absorbing them into their ancient and enduring culture. And while barbarian nomads might initially make fun of or scoff at the soft, luxurious life available to the Chinese, who are made rich by intensive agriculture, at the same time, they're intrigued and drawn to that sort of lifestyle. And another way that assimilation took place, just as in the Roman Empire, was by employing or incorporating warlike tribes into the Chinese military. Whether these soldiers were directly conscripted or served as mercenaries, they often then acquired Chinese customs, language, and sympathies. Two of the most famous archaeological monuments in the world, really, represent one more potential approach which was used by both Roman and Chinese empires for dealing with dangerous barbarians. And these are the Great Wall of China and Hadrian's Wall in Britain. Hadrian's Wall runs about 70 miles across northern Britain, and for most of that stretch, it's made up of solid stone blocks. So it forms a wall about 10 feet wide, 20 feet high. Watchtowers are spaced at about 500-yard intervals, and these are supplemented by about a dozen full-size forts. While Hadrian's Wall in Britain, as well as the more northerly Antonine Wall, are the best-known Roman border fortifications, they're by no means the only ones. The Romans also built walls, roads, ditches, outposts, watchtowers, and forts on almost all their other dangerous frontiers, including all along the Rhine River, the Danube River, off in the east, and then to the south along the border of the Saharan and Arabian deserts. There's a big debate among Roman historians concerning the intended purpose and function of all of these walls and fortifications. Even the most solid and continuous of them, something like Hadrian's Wall, would really not have been enough to stop a large or determined barbarian invasion. And so this has led to theories that these walls were really there to just deter small raiding parties or to serve as a kind of early warning system to detect and maybe slow down major invasions. Alternatively, they've been interpreted as actually having mainly an economic function, where the walls served as a way to regulate trade and made collecting customs taxes much easier. Others see them as symbolic statements of the limits of empire, or even just as busy work for the army. And the truth probably lies in some combination of all those different factors. In China, defensive walls have a very, very long history. They go back at least to the 7th century BC. And like most structures of those early dynasties, those earliest walls were built of wood and packed earth, so that almost nothing is left of them today. The famous stone sections of the Great Wall that you see in pictures today, those are actually very recent, dating to the Ming Dynasty of the 14th to 17th century AD. And the original version of that Great Wall, though, may have been another project of the same energetic Qin Emperor, Shi Wang Di, who, at least according to legend, was said to have employed hundreds of thousands of laborers in building a gigantic wood and earthen wall all the way across China's northern border. How reliable that account is, exactly where that wall was, are things that people are debating. But by the time of the Han Dynasty, there does seem to have been a well-recognized and extensive wall which delineated the northern frontier. And a surviving treaty between the Han and the nomadic horse archers to Xiongnu has a clause that states, the land north of the Great Wall, where men wield the bow and arrow, was to receive its command from the leader of the Xiongnu, while that region within the wall, whose inhabitants dwell in houses and wear hats and belts, was to be ruled by the Chinese emperor. So this reference clearly shows the wall in existence and that it was used to designate the boundary between China and outside regions. Many of the same arguments concerning the purpose and function of Hadrian's Wall exist for the Great Wall of China. At least in some of those earlier dynasties, China's walls do indeed seem to have been intended as a direct form of deterrence against invasion. But they were never viewed as a solution all alone. China's policy towards those northern barbarian tribes was always a mixture of different methods. Sometimes they would use naked military force, sometimes they would buy them off with money and gifts. Other times they would hire them as mercenaries, and other times they would try to assimilate them. In China and Rome, instances of heavy reliance on defensive walls can really be interpreted as signs of weakness, since in stronger moments, both those states would rely instead on mobile armies for their defense. Over the last three lectures, we've paused in the historical narrative to indulge in some more in-depth discussion of aspects of the Roman and Han empires. And I focused on a couple issues, such as administration, leadership, assimilation, and scale. And I thought those made for some interesting comparisons. But there really are many other characteristics of those two empires that one might have picked for a similar analysis. You could look at their economies, systems of law, coinage, or struggles with new religions. One final comparison that I want to make between Rome and China has to do with attitude. Both civilizations came to view themselves as worldwide civilizations, and more than that, as cultures with a special destiny to rule over all others. In the great foundational epic poem of Rome, the Aeneid, the author Virgil famously stated that the gods had given to Rome empire without end. And even Rome's enemies viewed the Romans as universal conquerors. And we see this exemplified in a Greek author, Polybius, who himself was a victim of Roman imperialism. And he began his history by stating that he would explain how the entire world had been brought under the control of the Romans. The Chinese considered their state to encompass all under heaven. And China itself, of course, was called the Middle Kingdom, of which the rest of the world was seen as just an insignificant fringe. In future lectures, we'll return both to the Mediterranean and to China to see what happens when these empires fall. But first, we'll make a rather dramatic shift in geography to an entirely new region of the world that I haven't even mentioned yet. And whereas all the cultures and regions that we've looked at so far have had at least some tenuous links with one another, we're now going to jump to an area that's been developing in complete and total isolation from the rest of the world. For the next three lectures, we will turn to North and South America and to the great early civilizations of the New World. Thank you.